Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. The COVID-19 vaccine has finally reached our state, and as of the beginning of this week, over 325,000 New Mexicans have signed up to receive their first dose. But folks also have questions. How does this vaccine work? How soon can you actually expect to receive it? And how effective will it be, especially now that the new coronavirus variant strain has been detected here? This morning, we will be speaking to experts about the science behind the vaccine, the Department of Health's strategies for making sure it's distributed in the most effective way, and what it's actually like to get this life-saving shot. And we want to hear from you. Do you have concerns about this vaccine? Would you like to know more about how the state is deciding who gets it first? Email us at letstalk@kunm.org or call in live at 277-5866. My first guest is Dr. David Peabody, a professor of molecular genetics and microbiology with the University of New Mexico and a vaccine researcher and developer. Good morning, Dr. Peabody. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing great here. So let's just get started with the basics. It's been a while since I took a high school science class, so I'd imagine a few of our listeners might need a brush up on this. How does a vaccine, any kind of vaccine, work to protect your body from a viral infection?
Well, the way vaccines work in general is to, in effect, mimic the consequences of an actual infection without causing disease. So maybe it's useful to spend a moment talking about what a virus is and what it does and how we respond to virus infection. So if we take SARS-CoV-2, the causative agent of COVID-19, mm-hmm. as an example, the virus itself is a small particle, we might say nanoparticle, because it's extremely tiny, much mm-hmm. smaller even than a cell. And it's, I think many people are familiar probably from illustrations they've seen of the virus, of its basic structure. But this is a virus that is basically a sphere with a membrane studded with a protein called the spike protein. Mm-hmm. And inside that ball, in the interior of the ball, is the viral genome, the genes that encode the proteins responsible for all of the things that the virus does. Mm-hmm. So when this spike protein on the surface of the viral particle encounters a susceptible cell, it, through the spike protein, binds to the cell surface. Mm-hmm. The virus enters the cell and liberates its genome into the cell, the genes of the virus, which are then copied into what we call messenger RNA molecules mm-hmm. by a process called transcription. And those messenger RNA molecules, in turn, are used as templates for the synthesis of viral proteins. So when a virus infects the cell, a virus like SARS-CoV-2, it produces dozens of different proteins responsible for assembling the structure of new viral particles, responsible for replicating the viral genome, and for carrying out all of the interactions that the virus carries out with, mm-hmm. with the cell. So the object of a vaccine then, so the immune system responds then to that infection by recognizing, especially in the case of this particular virus, by generating antibodies that recognize the viral spike protein. So a subsequent infection is inhibited by binding of antibodies to the spike protein, which is necessary. The spike protein is necessary for entry mm-hmm. into new susceptible cells. So the object of a vaccine, and the object of virtually all the vaccines under development for SARS-CoV-2, is to cause the immune system to respond to that spike protein without the necessity of an actual infection.
Right. So yeah. it creates a response in the body without the actual virus going into the body. Is that right?
That's right. So shall we take the messenger RNA vaccines, the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines as examples? They so, and kind of in the same sense that a virus particle itself is in effect a gene delivery vehicle, mm-hmm. these vaccines are producing, in effect, a gene delivery vehicle in the form of a small nanoparticle, a lipid sort of greasy ball.
A tiny fat with, particle,
yes,
basically?
Yes, that's right. And that encloses or encapsulates a messenger RNA molecule. Mm-hmm. So messenger RNA is, as I say, the template for protein synthesis. And so when this particle interacts with cells, it liberates into the interior of the cell these messenger RNA molecules mm-hmm. that are specific for spike protein synthesis.
Okay.
And so what happens then is our own cells are utilized to produce the protein, the spike protein, to which our immune system responds to produce anti-spike antibodies that neutralize the virus particle.
So it gets our cells to kind of fake a COVID-19 virus.
Yeah, in a sense that's true. But rather than producing the many proteins of the virus responsible for a complete cycle of infection, we produce only that single protein. So there's no way, for example, that these vaccines can cause a COVID infection themselves because mm-hmm. they lack all of the other genetic information of the virus, but the information for this one particular protein.
So COVID-19 is not in this vaccination, but instead it's sort of tricking the cells into responding as though it were, but there's no way of like getting sick from COVID-19 is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. It is not possible in principle for these things to cause an actual infection because mm-hmm. they possess just a tiny fraction of the genetic information required for virus infection and replication and so forth.
And you said this is the mRNA virus vaccination that people have heard about that we're using here in New Mexico. Is that the main advantage of using this kind of vaccine? Is that there's simply no COVID-19 in it, so it's impossible to get someone sick from it?
Well, that's certainly one safety advantage. I mean, traditionally, many viral vaccines have been made by either inactivating a whole virus or mm-hmm. by making so-called attenuated or weakened strains of the virus.
Right. These are like the dead virus.
Yeah, that's right. And so they are different in that they contain normally everything that the virus contains just mm-hmm. in an inactivated or weakened form. These mRNA vaccines, and I should say in general, other so-called genetic vaccines, the AstraZeneca vaccine mm-hmm. is in this general category, although it works by a different molecular mechanism. Mm-hmm. These vaccines are incapable of causing anything like a normal viral infection.
Now, will they be effective against this new variant that we're hearing so much about, these same vaccines?
So variants, of course, are constantly arising. Mutation mm-hmm. is just a fact of life for all biological entities. Genetic systems do not replicate themselves perfectly, and they make errors from time to time that result in mutations. This particular virus doesn't have a very high mutation frequency, mm-hmm. unlike influenza, for example, where we clearly need a new vaccine every year. This is a virus that mutates relatively slowly, mm-hmm. But the generation of variants like this is something that needs to be watched and can be concerning. So far, the variants that have arisen, at least the ones that have been tested, seem to be still susceptible to neutralization.
So it is still effective against these variants.
That the non-variant virus elicits.
Mm-hmm.
But it pays to pay attention to the emergence of these things. Now, I should mention in that connection that one of the other advantages of these kinds of vaccines, these so-called genetic vaccines, or in these specific cases, these mRNA vaccines, is how rapidly they can be produced. So in other words, these vaccines, once you have the genome sequence of the virus, it's a matter of, so for example, we got the genome sequence of SARS-CoV-2 last January, and within days, vaccine candidates were being produced by this mRNA technology, and everybody since then is aware of how rapidly they've gone through further development to the point now that they're actually in use. But that same rapidity of that initial response allows adaptation to any changes in the virus. These mutations are generally minor tweaks in the sequence of the spike protein, and they can be quite easily and rapidly accommodated in new versions of the vaccine as they become necessary.
And then I know a lot of people have heard that it's an mRNA vaccine, and they're worried that it might somehow affect their own DNA of their bodies. Is that a concern?
Not really. Messenger RNA, as a general class of molecules, is a normal constituent of all of our cells. It is the intermediate between genes and proteins that that specifies the synthesis of protein. So every protein you produce in your cells is made by messenger RNA. Messenger RNAs have a relatively short lifetime. So over time, they degrade. They disappear. And so the stuff doesn't hang around all of that long. And in any event, it is incapable of being converted to the more stable form of nucleic acid, the form that actually make up the genes of our body, DNA. So the mRNA vaccines, I don't think there's any expectation that they will persist for any length of time, for any long period of time, as a component of ourselves.
Now, speaking of long periods of time, what are some, are there any concerns about long-term effects of this vaccination? Is it something that people should feel safe about taking at this point?
So, of course, the necessity for the rapid response to the pandemic has made it impossible so far to do really long-term safety studies. I'm unaware of any real theoretical reason to think that they should have a long-term consequence other than to, you know, engender immunity. But of course, we'll only know that for sure as we study these things over the long term. It seems like any effects that we're seeing so far are extremely rare and acute and short term. But
what kind of effects are we seeing?
Well, so mainly we're talking about adverse reactions like injection site pain, maybe a slight inflammatory reaction, maybe some body aches, even in some cases a little fever for a day or two. But the kinds of things that are not so uncommon, for example, with an influenza vaccine.
Right. Like kind of your typical vaccine effects, the anything too harmful would be very rare.
That's right. Now, I might mention in connection with long-term effects, I think people should be a lot more worried about the long-term effects of a COVID infection than the effects of this virus.
All right. Well, we do need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman, and we will be back in a moment.
Support comes from Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm, whose criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions, beginning January 1st, 2020. RothsteinLaw.com. Support comes from the Canteen Brewhouse and the Canteen Taproom, open 7 days a week from 2 to 7. To-go orders of locally brewed beer, growlers, crowlers, six-packs, and root beer are available.
When Marie Theresa Coincoin was granted her freedom in 1778, she used her business skill to become a landowner. Her goal was to purchase the freedom of her children. Composer Jason Moran is Coincoin's great-great-grandnephew. Music inspired by her story and his family history on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are taking your calls about the COVID-19 vaccine. Will you be signing up to receive your first dose? Give us a call at 277-5866 and let us know. Now, I'd also like to bring into the conversation Matt Bieber, the Director of Communications for New Mexico's Department of Health, which is overseeing the COVID-19 vaccine distribution. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Ty. Thanks for having me on.
Certainly. So, first of all, the state is using a phased system for distributing the vaccine, meaning that it's only available for certain folks right now. Why is it important to use this phased distribution system?
Well, let's be clear. This isn't just New Mexico. This is the whole country. Every state's doing this, and we're doing it at the recommendation of CDC, which developed the phases initially. And we're doing it fundamentally because there just simply isn't enough vaccine for everybody who wants it right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I have a call from Lorraine in Taos. Good morning, Lorraine. What is your question or comment?
Good morning. I have COPD, and I also am deathly allergic to bee stings. And as I was listening to you, I have another problem. I didn't take the flu shot this year because I've had reactions like I get the flu, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm elderly, so I just wondered... I've had other people in the community pass away at approximately my age because they have asthma.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't know what's happening concerning this vaccine, you know.
Are you concerned about allergic reactions to the vaccine?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me pitch that to Dr. Peabody real quick here. Dr. Peabody, are you still on the line?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so do you have any advice for Lorraine in considering signing up for the vaccine with these potential complications, COPD and asthma and allergic reactions?
Well, I wouldn't presume to give her medical advice, and I'd certainly encourage her to consult with her doctor about what additional risks there may be. One of the rare complications that's been observed with this vaccine is the occasional induction of what's called anaphylaxis, a severe immune reaction that requires immediate medical attention. And certainly people that have had reactions to vaccines or vaccine components in the past of that kind of nature should be probably not taking this vaccine. But other than that sort of general advice, I wouldn't presume to give specific medical advice to someone.
And that's extremely rare, though, the anaphylaxis reaction.
It is. There have been in the many thousands of vaccines given, I think some dozens of cases. I may have those numbers wrong, but it's not. A common reaction, and vaccination sites are advised to be prepared to deal with those kinds of complications should they occur. And I think anyone who's had a vaccination will know that they're asked to stay around for 15 to 30 minutes after vaccination to make sure that they don't have that sort of reaction, which normally occurs almost immediately after vaccination.
Okay, thank you. And Matt Bieber, with the Department of Health, is there a way that a caller like, or a person like Lorraine, who is concerned about potential reactions to the vaccine, is there a way that she can kind of find out whether or not these are things that she needs to worry about in signing up for the vaccine?
Yeah, let me describe the steps involved in signing up and the process through which New Mexicans go between signing up and getting vaccine, and I think that'll explain or address some of Lorraine's concerns along the way. Is that all right?
That sounds great.
Great. So the way this process works, we're encouraging all New Mexicans to go to vaccinenm.org. So far, we're now crested 400,000 New Mexicans who've signed up for vaccine. What we ask for when you sign up, it's sort of like signing up for an Amazon or Netflix account, just some basic information. In our case, we ask for employment information and health information in particular, because those are the key factors for determining who gets vaccine when. Because of this phased approach, what we're doing is prioritizing vaccine for people who are most exposed to COVID at their jobs, mm-hmm. or who are most vulnerable to COVID because of pre-existing health conditions or because of their age, like Lorraine indicated she was elderly. So when we have that information, it allows us to take the incoming vaccine, to take the providers who have vaccine, and match it up with people in their area who qualify for vaccine right now, and then send out invitations to those people, typically via text message, but also via email and other methods, to invite them to schedule a vaccination in their area. When they do that, they log into the site, they choose a provider in their area, it could be CVS or Walmart or Vita or many others. They choose a time just from an appointment schedule. And then on the day of their appointment, they fill out one last medical questionnaire, just assessing their health that day, so that the provider has a clear picture of their health that day. Then they show up for their appointment and they have a conversation where the provider can review that form and ask any relevant questions about their health. So as you can see, there are a bunch of checks along the way to make sure that people who, the small number of people who might have a condition mm-hmm. that suggests they shouldn't get the vaccine, that'll get discovered along the way, and the provider will have all the information they need to make a sound medical decision that day.
So there is a provider kind of at the end of the line who's going to be able to consider whether or not this is an appropriate shot for a person.
Absolutely. And at that point, you know, that's a human-to-human conversation. The New Mexican shows up at the vaccine site and they can ask the questions that are on the top of their mind in addition to answering the ones that the provider may have for them.
Okay. And I have a call from Marilee in Albuquerque. Good morning, Marilee. What is your question?
Good morning. I also have a sort of a different slant on the concern about allergic reactions or funny reactions. I have had strange reactions to some other drugs, and they weren't anaphylactic, but they were very scary. So I am wondering if there is any thought of or any activity toward developing some kind of way for extremely sensitive people to get tested or something, you know, like with a tiny little test sample of the vaccine or something, so that we could sort of screen ourselves in advance.
So, Matt, is that a possibility at this point or a necessity?
I think I would want to defer to Dr. Peabody here about how and maybe it would be helpful, Doctor, if you could share a little bit about the research that's already been done about how the vaccine was developed and the adverse reaction information that emerged from that research. I'm no expert on the kinds of medical detail this caller is asking about.
Okay. Dr. Peabody?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, neither am I. I mean, the common adverse reactions are well characterized. What specific conditions might predispose someone to an adverse reaction, and how to test for those are something I don't really have specific knowledge of, I'm afraid.
So this, again, sounds like maybe a conversation between you and your provider when you actually get to that human-to-human conversation. Is that a fair?
I think all sort of individual circumstances like this merit a conversation with the provider.
Okay, and so going back to the phase system that we're using, Matt Bieber, we are in phase 1B right now. Could you tell me who is eligible right now to receive the vaccine?
Absolutely. If I may, let me paint a picture of the whole phase system
sure.
and then dial in specifically on 1B. So there are four phases, 1A, 1B, 1C, and 2. 1A was primarily healthcare workers, in addition to staff at congregate care settings and EMTs, first responders, folks in that category who have direct patient care responsibilities. And for the reasons I described earlier, vaccine was made available to them first because they were at highest risk of exposure. We've now vaccinated a high proportion of that group and have opened up phase 1B, which includes four categories of people: 75 plus, so anybody 75 years of age or older, anybody 16 and older who has a qualifying medical condition, and we have a full list when folks register on the website. After that comes a series of categories of frontline essential workers. Again, all of this is also detailed on our website. And then finally, residents of congregate care settings, so shelters, prisons, juvenile facilities, et cetera. What we're doing, just to give a clear picture of what that all means for New Mexico, the people who fall into the category of 16 plus with a medical condition is more than 500,000 people in New Mexico. And so we're talking about a quarter of our state that falls in just a portion of phase 1B. So one, this means a couple things. First, it means that we are likely to be in phase 1B for some time, because at present, we're getting something on the order of 20 to 40,000 vaccine doses per week from the federal government. And obviously, there's a great many more people in New Mexico who qualify in this phase than we have vaccine on hand right now. So it's going to take us a little while to move through the phase. We're hoping to get the phase done by this spring. What it also means is that if you're in 1A, or if you're in the top portion of 1B, meaning folks that are 75 plus, or very soon folks 16 plus with medical conditions, you should now be expecting to receive invitations from the Department of Health to go schedule your vaccine appointment in the very near future. Mm-hmm. We're now inviting folks in those categories.
Okay. And I have a call from Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill.
Yes, good morning, Ty, and good morning to your guests. Dr. Fauci and Dr. William Schaffner from Vanderbilt University Medical Center, professor, expert in preventive medicine and infectious diseases, epidemics, and viruses. Both have said recently that you're not aware of the protocol has been changed. Both say that anyone over 55 should immediately be vaccinated. So I suggest that your experts get on the line and call these two experts, Dr. Fauci and Dr. William Schaffner from Vanderbilt University, and get things straight. They're so busy that they don't understand that protocol has changed.
Well, thank you, Bill. So, Matt, what is your response to Bill's comment there?
Well, in addition to, there's been a lot in the news on this topic, so I would like to lay out the sequence of events lately. So in addition to comments like that, the incoming Biden administration has signaled that they would like to move the age qualification for vaccine right now down to 65, I believe. The Trump administration has indicated they'd like to do the same, but there's a couple key facts here. First, the Trump's policy wouldn't actually go into effect for a couple more weeks, basically until the Biden administration comes into office. That doesn't happen for another week and a half or so, a week at this point. And in addition, the way this process has worked is that the CDC created phase guidance recommendations, but the states actually had the authority to adopt them or adjust them as they saw fit. And that's exactly what happened here in New Mexico. So there's no new governing policy at the federal government that supplants New Mexico's policy. Our policy is still policy right now. And if that changes when the Biden team comes into office, then we'll obviously adjust at that point. But those recommendations from the federal level are really just recommendations. And it's important to remember that we've got to factor all of these recommendations in to the available vaccine we have. And the key fact here is that if we had enough vaccine to vaccinate all of New Mexico who wanted vaccine right now, we would do that. Mm-hmm. But we don't. And so we're working with the quantity we have and looking to get it out as expeditiously and efficiently as possible.
OK. Okay. And I have a call from Dr. Laura Hobson, who, Dr. Hobson, I understand that you did receive your first vaccine dose. Can you tell me how that went?
Yes, I got my first vaccine last week, and I'd like to share my experience and some of my other observations. I registered on the state's vaccine website and got my event code and was scheduled in a couple days. And when I checked in the pharmacy, the tech said I needed to fill out another health form and provide my pharmacy benefit card. I told her I provided all of that on the state's website, and she said they did not have any access to that information. I happened to only have my health insurance card with me and not a pharmacy benefit card. She was prepared to turn me away, saying that Walmart needed that card in order to get paid for the vaccine. She was able to finally retrieve my information by checking several pharmacy plans with my husband's date of birth. Our insurance is through his employer. And I had to walk to the farthest corner of the store where the clinic was actually set up. I estimated I had to walk about 200 yards round trip to get my vaccine. And I thought of my own patients who have heart and lung disease and an orthopedic problem on top of that. And there is no way some of them would be able to walk the same path I did. When I was there, there were three pharmacists and three booths, and I was the only patient in a half an hour. And I'm surprised there weren't more people scheduled, like every 5 minutes rotating in and out of there. And I'm wondering, who's paying for these pharmacists just to sit there and do nothing? And then while I was still there, I got a text message stating the date and time of my second dose. And I asked the pharmacist if he could change it, and he said, no, I needed to do that through the state's website. And I just this morning tried to change the appointment. And on the state website, you can't change an appointment. You can only cancel it, which I did. And then I tried to reschedule. And the event code I was originally issued is no longer working. And so right now, I'm not scheduled for a follow-up. And, you know, what do I do next? The pharmacy can't schedule, and the website is not allowing it.
Okay,
do you have any? Oh,
well, thank you, Dr. Hobson. I was just going to ask Matt Bieber. What can Dr. Hobson do in this kind of situation?
Sure. Let me provide a little context if I can. So this state of New Mexico's website is the only one of its kind in the country that allows New Mexicans to register for vaccine and go through a process, schedule appointments, and attend them. I know it's not perfect, but I want to just set expectations appropriately. This website has been stood up in the course of 3 weeks. This is the kind of technology that ideally you'd have years to develop, roll out, test. We just don't have that kind of time. And so we're doing our very best. And by and large, it's working very well. As I said, we're now well over 400,000 New Mexicans. Just to give a comparison, in Florida, the state is distributing Eventbrite invitations. So they're using a concert ticketing website, and it's not working well at all. So we are very conscious that there are imperfections in the system, but I also just want to point out that other states are now coming to us to ask, how can we learn from what you've done? With regard to the specific question around insurance, I'm going to follow up with our team there. The short answer to that question is, if you've entered your information, your insurance information in our site, you should not have to enter it anywhere else again. And the providers should have clear access to that information. So I'm sorry you had that experience. That was an inappropriate response on their part, and I'm gonna do what I can to ensure that that sort of thing doesn't continue to happen. With regard to rescheduling, I'm conscious of the challenge she's described. We are improving the feature set within the app or within the website so that folks can do all of the standard things you'd want to be able to do with scheduling. There is this. This is one of the issues that can arise because of limited vaccine availability. But the long and short of it is, if you have a vaccination appointment scheduled, you should have the capacity to reschedule it. That shouldn't be a significant barrier. So, Dr. Hobson, I'm gonna make sure I take down your name, and I'm gonna check with our team and to ensure that you get another invitation that allows you to reschedule your appointment.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Matt. And it is time for another quick break. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. We'll be back in a minute.
From Washington, D.C. to Hong Kong, civil resistance movements are erupting. To what effect? On the next edition of Alternative Radio, hear Erica Chanoweth on civil resistance in the 21st century. That's Alternative Radio, Saturday evenings at 6, right here on 89.9 FM KUNM, KUNM.org, Albuquerque.
On the next Native America Calling, our Native in the Spotlight worked on Joe Biden's presidential campaign and built a consultant business helping tribes with complex issues. Clara Pratt recently won a prestigious environmental award. When we sign on air again, we'll find out what drives her success and what her hopes are for 2021.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. We're talking about the COVID-19 vaccine today, and we're taking your calls. You can reach us at 277-5866. I'd like to bring in another guest now, Jalen Ellis, the Residency Program Coordinator at, and I'm sorry, I may say this name wrong, Rehoboth McKinley Christian Hospital in Gallup, as well as a birth doula with Mama Bear Births. Good morning, and thank you for joining us, Jalen.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me this morning. I appreciate it.
Certainly. Now, you have received both doses of the vaccine. Could you walk us through how the process went for you?
Yes, of course. So I am a staff member at our local hospital, which is the biggest rural hospital in our area, RMCHCS. And the way that we had it scheduled for staff was we vaccinated our ICU and med-surg staff first, the staff that we had on the front lines, and then we tiered it down to other staff that do patient care and then administration. And I currently fall in the administration category. So it was quite simple. Our administration actually organized the vaccinations for all of the staff and sent out reminder emails. Mm-hmm. They scheduled the first vaccination appointment and the second vaccination appointment for all of us. Mm-hmm. In our biggest meeting room in the hospital. So how the process went for me was I had my first appointment scheduled. I went in and I received my vaccination. I was a little hesitant as far as the side effects. I never once debated on whether I was going to get it or not. Mm-hmm. I am immune compromised and I am high risk. So I knew that this was something that I needed personally. Mm-hmm. The reason why I was a little bit hesitant as far as the side effects is because I've had pretty severe fibromyalgia since I was about 10 years old. And I know from past experiences with other vaccines that it triggers a huge flare up. So I made sure that I was prepared for that. Yesterday, I received my second vaccination, and so today is a little tough, but it was expected. I'm glad that I got this process started.
Now, there are reports around the country of some healthcare workers who are declining the vaccine. What do you have to say to folks who might be on the fence about getting this?
I think the folks that are on the fence, I think they need to have a really good, honest talk with their primary care doctor, if they have one, and really debate the risks of not getting it and the risks of getting it. The deciding factor for me was my primary care doctor gave the same injection. So we have the Pfizer vaccine at our hospital, and she gave the same injection to her husband and other members of her family and herself. So in my mind, if my provider was willing to inject her family with the same vaccine that she was recommending to me, then it was as safe as possible for what information she had. So I think for people on the fence, they just need to have a really honest talk with their primary care doctor and come to a conclusion that fits right to their scenario.
Well, thank you for calling in and sharing your experience, Jalen. I have a call from Ellen in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ellen. What is your question today?
Oh, good morning, folks. Nice to talk to you again, Ty.
It's good to talk
to
you.
Anyway, I have concerns about for people who don't drive. That includes me and my husband. And also, we are also legally blind as well. I understand you have to go through the website and whatever. We have signed up for it. And unfortunately, you know, I understand that this is a timely thing. And we have to schedule SunVan 3 days in advance. So I'm wondering if the people who are administering these vaccines are willing to work with us as far as getting rides to and not necessarily from, but just getting there to receive it. And on top of that, scheduling for the second dose because of the fact that some of us either have screen readers on our computers or we don't have a computer. And I've also heard that so when you call the hotline, you can't get in.
Well, thank you for your call, Ellen. Matt, what about folks who have transportation issues like this or other physical limitations?
It's a great question. And the short answer is we're developing plans to support folks in exactly these kinds of situations. And there are any number of groups who need and deserve and are going to get the support they need to both register and get vaccine. So the group that this caller just called from, obviously folks who are legally blind and can't drive, that would fall in that category. We're also thinking very hard about homebound seniors more broadly. We're thinking about the homeless population. We're thinking about folks cycling in and out of prisons. These are all, to us, folks that absolutely need the same opportunity to get vaccine as anyone else, and we're developing operational plans that will support them. And then we'll be communicating about those plans in the very near future.
Okay. And I have a call from Damien in Los Lunas. Good morning, Damien. What is your comment?
Yes, good morning. My question is addressing a concern that I have read about, and at least peripherally is kind of reinforced by the call that the doctor made earlier.
Are you still there, Damien? I feel like we may have lost you.
No, I'm still
okay.
Here.
Hello? Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
My question has to deal with wastage and the accounts of other healthcare professionals who felt constrained by the system to administer doses only to the prioritized recipients, and when people either didn't show up or refused the vaccine, they had to go searching for people who were eligible. And what this resulted in was wastage. Now, given the wasted doses, now given the, I believe, 6-hour viability of both the Pfizer and I think the Moderna vaccine, and in light of what the doctor said about waiting in line and pharmacists apparently there who were not doing anything, what is the policy with regards to doses that have not been administered that are approaching the limits of their viability?
All right. Thank you, Damien. Matt Bieber.
Thanks for the question. So Department of Health has had clear guidance to providers about this very issue for some time. And last week just updated that guidance, I should say requirements, really. We're very conscious of precisely these challenges. And I think the caller raises the two horns of this dilemma and names them very well. On one hand, we absolutely don't want to waste any vaccine, not a single dose. On the other hand, we don't have enough vaccine to get to everybody, even in the current phases. And so there's a balance to be struck about, you know, how do you invite people and ensure that the appointments are filled without inviting so many people that folks are disappointed because the event fills up.
Okay. So I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
Policy is, and here's how. Would you like me to stop there?
No. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
Sure. So the policy in place, and this applies to every provider in the state, it surrounds two scenarios. What's happening? What do you do if you're getting first into a 48-hour window and then into a six-hour window in which vaccine is approaching that expiry date? The caller was a little off on the numbers. It's a several-day period that the vaccine is good once it thaws, in the case of Pfizer. So there's a couple days. It's not quite as narrow a window as he thought, but that's okay. There is an expiry period. He's absolutely right about that. And when providers get to that point, first within 48 hours and then within six, they're required to communicate with DOH, and they can do so via the website that I described earlier. They can actually let us know this many doses is within this many hours of expiring, and we can help push additional invitations to folks in that area in the existing phase or even in the potentially next phase to make sure those vaccines get used. By the same token, when providers are having trouble filling appointments for a couple days in a row in the current phase, they can communicate with us and get permission to go what we call out of phase, which means into the next subphase or into the next phase, again, so that we're not wasting doses. So it's a tricky balancing act, and we're doing our very best, but we think we've struck a pretty good balance and have a policy in place that accommodates these tricky scenarios.
Thank you for your call, Damien. Our next guest today is Dr. Emily Houses, a nurse and a researcher with the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation and a member of the Chiricahua Fort Sill Apache tribe. Good morning, Dr. Houses.
Good morning.
So thank you for joining us. And I want to point out that you are yourself a COVID survivor. Of course, we're talking about preventing COVID, but could you tell me what about the experience of actually having gone through the disease? What were your symptoms like?
Sure. So I contracted COVID very early in the pandemic in March, when we didn't know a whole lot about it. So I just want to start there. My symptoms were cough, low-grade fever. I had a wicked migraine, probably the worst headache I've had, terrible nausea and vomiting and other gastrointestinal symptoms that nobody wants to hear about, and shortness of breath that just got progressively worse. It came in two phases. I had like a week where I was really sick, and then I started to feel better, and then it came back and it was worse. And the symptoms that were really worse were the shortness of breath.
Now, how long did the whole infection last for you?
So I was really sick for about 6 weeks, maybe 2 months, but I this is the really scary part, is that I still have problems. I still have fatigue. I don't tolerate exercise well. Where I used to be really active and exercise, every other day and go out on the weekends and enjoy my life, now I basically spend my weekends recuperating from the work week.
And that's 10 months later, you're still experiencing these symptoms?
Yeah.
Now, you are an advocate for Native American health and social justice, and I know a lot of your research centers on health disparities in Native communities. Can you tell me about how those disparities should be considered in making sure that this vaccine gets distributed to those populations?
That's a great question. We Native American populations have often been overlooked or under considered when it comes to healthcare, and this is a time where that chicken has come home to roost. We have seen terrible disparities in infection rates in our Native communities. Right now, we are about 16% of the population of Native Americans in New Mexico are represented in the COVID rates, where we're only 10% of the actual population. At some points, it was up to 50%. So we know that this has been a real, it's been terrible for us. I can't really express how bad the COVID pandemic has been in our Native communities. We really need to turn the focus on how can we address this disparity. We need vaccinations. We need to focus on some of the root causes on why we had such a terrible outbreak of the pandemic in our communities so it doesn't happen again.
Now, I want to go to Matt Bieber real quick. Matt, I know that the Indian Health Service administers the vaccine distribution on Native lands. But is the Department of Health taking any steps to make sure that Native populations in other parts of the state are able to receive the vaccine in a timely manner?
Yes, absolutely. One quick qualification to what you just said is all the Native communities in the state were given the choice about whether they wanted to receive vaccine from IHS or from the state. Mm-hmm. Most chose to receive it from IHS, but the last I was aware, three, Laguna, Acoma, and Picarice Pueblos chose to receive their allocations from the state. So we have been directly involved with those three Pueblos distributing vaccine. And the way it works is they get their allocation and then they have the authority to distribute those vaccines within their communities as they see fit. Broadly speaking, that's been going very well. And then in addition, and to address the issue that your other guest mentioned, we're also very conscious that Native communities have been hit especially hard. And we have an equity working group within the department. And this is part of the work I described earlier of reaching hard to reach or underserved communities and making sure that we're getting out effective and clear and transparent information about the vaccine to all those communities and that they're receiving the support that they feel they need.
Mm-hmm. And so back to you, Dr. Houses. Of course, there is an ugly history with the U.S. government, and I guess I say its approaches to disease when it comes to Natives. Is that something that you think might make some folks hesitant about signing up for the vaccine?
I know it is. I see a lot of people discussing in social media, and we definitely enjoy our social media. I see them discussing this hesitancy because we have been over-researched. We have been unethically used in research in the past for medical testing. And so there is this reluctance. People are very concerned about whether or not Native Americans are again being used as guinea pigs. And so there is that question of, should I get this vaccine? Are they just going to use my data again? And is it really in the interest of Native people to receive the vaccine? What I am seeing is a lot of the counter argument of, I want to see my family. I want to see my father. I want to see my grandparents. And we have been separated for so long. I personally have barely seen anybody in my family since March, and I really miss them.
Will you be receiving the vaccine?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are quickly running out of time. Matt Bieber, real quick, what is the website people can go to find out more information?
VaccineNM.org.
Okay. And that is all the time that we have today. Thank you so much to everyone who called in. We had so many calls, we could not possibly get to them all. But you can go to our website as well, KUNM Radio, and see the website for the show, and we'll have some resources there. Thank you so much to our guests, Dr. David Peabody, Matt Bieber from the Department of Health, Jalen Ellis, and Dr. Emily Houses. Let's keep this conversation going. You can share your thoughts on Twitter, hashtag Let's Talk NM. Search for KUNM Radio on Facebook or email letstalk@KUNM.org. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Kaveh Movahead screened your calls. Taylor Velasquez live tweeted the show today, and Megan Kamrick produced the show. I'm Ty Bannerman. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.